afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name's Erin Ryan.
That was weird. Yeah, that was me talking to me.
I was looking right at you, and I didn't see your lips
like,
move.
Whoa.
It's amazing.
I was a little late on I was a little late on the grab, but I thought, how did that happen?
There was some technical issues. I'm sorry for this inconvenience, but we have a live show today.
Oh, sure we do. Hey, next time we do a replay, let's do it like that. Oh, no, this is live. It is. Wink, wink. You can't see winks over the radio. That's great. So I'm Erin Ryan in recording and in real life.
In real life, yes.
That's usually more than most people want.
My name's Bill Kendiff, and our sponsor this morning is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Right now, you can get a great deal on a new tractor, mower, implements. They got it all up there. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Phone number is 530-226-9226. Or go to the web at papemachinery.com. There you go. So what are you doing over there, weather girl?
It felt like we were in Florida. It's hot in here. Hot and shreddy. That's probably why I was being recorded. They were afraid I was going to pass out. They thought they'd use my fake self. So let's see. Today is October 22nd, 2023, because we will replay this show at a future time, which just brings back that whole time traveling thing. But this is part of our series that we have been doing with Paul Skinner from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He's a member of Team Adam, and his professional experience of 4 decades working in municipal policing and working in the criminal justice system in the prosecution of offenders. He's a graduate of the FBI National Academy, where he majored in the management of cold case investigations. Additionally, he has experience as an adjunct instructor for Humphreys University, teaching criminal justice students in advanced, complicated investigations. I would think all of them are complicated, but apparently there's some that are more complicated even, extra complicated. As a member of Team Adam, Paul brings experience in the areas of cold case investigations, spatial behavior of offenders, and the prosecution of no-body homicide cases. We have not discussed those yet, but that's in the offing. So the first program we did was August 6th of this year, and we kind of talked about the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And from the people that I ran into after the show, so many people said, okay, I had no idea what you were talking about, and then I realized I see the logo everywhere. So apparently we all know more about it than we thought. Then on September 17th, there was a focus on the exploited children, so the Exploitation of Children program. I would really encourage you, if you missed it, to go back and listen to it. It was super interesting, and it affects kids that you know, nieces, nephews, your children, grandkids. It's a really wide subject, and people think, oh, well, none of this is going to have anything to do with, you know, my kid. We kind of learned it's going to have something to do with everybody's kid if we're not careful. So those are tagged on the website at wethepeopleradio.us, so they're on there commercial-free. They're free to listen to. You can share them with anybody. We're not copyright people, so you can just do whatever you want. We're doing this to educate the public. So today's focus is on missing children.
You know, you said the good old days when kids used to play outside and wait till the streetlights came on. I saw a picture the other day online of a bunch of kids playing out in the street, and it was almost dark, and you could see the the streetlights popping on, and gosh, anymore, you just don't see that. You can't let your kids go out and play until dark, unattended.
I saw a kid. Where was I? I was waiting for something, and I looked over, and here from out from behind a fence came a kid who was probably 5 pushing a kid in a stroller who was probably 1, and they were just happily going on down the street. And I'm looking everywhere for adults, and I thought, yeah, I don't know. I was kind of having a little.
Well, there was last night when he almost hit a kid in the middle of the street. I mean,
yeah, it was a cat. Bill's like, it looked just like a kid.
It was a white cat. I swear to God, it was almost 3 feet tall, and it was right in the middle of the street, and the headlights hit it, and I'm like, look out! It was a cat.
Had he been, and it was, been drinking?
And it was white. I mean, it was a white, white cat. I'm like, is our neighborhood riddled with albino midgets these days?
Like, can you say midgets? I don't think so.
Is that a thing?
Just oh, my like, goodness.
It's a cat. Wow. So, yeah, on that on that note. All right, so today's focus is missing. And that is... He's actually given us notes today. We're cheating. Just, you know, full disclosure here.
A lot of good they're doing.
Yeah. a lot of good the notes are doing. Here, you can have half the notes. I've got the other half. No, but, you know, the thing is, I think people have figured this out by now. I mean, heck, we've been doing this a while. Honestly, there is so much stuff that we all don't know. And so if you're going to have people come on and talk about it and you have to be an expert before you bring them on,
yeah, good luck.
You're going to do a show about nothing every week because you're just going to talk about, you know, the little tiny bit of information in the world you have. So I guess it's the 20th anniversary of Team Atom.
It is.
And so, okay, we didn't ever ask you this before, but I'm kind of curious. So what's the deal with Team Atom in the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children? Because they are two different things, but they work together? Is
no,
that the deal?
We're actually a part of NCMEC,
okay.
An integral part of NCMEC. There's 158 of us throughout the U.S. We are responsible by congressional mandate to respond to cases where law enforcement needs us to provide additional resources for them for the investigation. And Team Atom was established 20 years ago as a result, unfortunately, of John and Reeve Adams missing their child or losing their child at a mall in Florida. He was unfortunately found later on deceased. And it was readily identified that there was a problem coordinating local law enforcement organizations and making sure that information was clear and concise and got throughout the region involving missing children. So at the time, John contacted then President Reagan and explained the problem. And President Reagan said, we will fix that. And within 2 weeks... he had legislation in front of Congress establishing NCMEC. And part of NCMEC is Team Atom. We are all retired homicide investigators, forensic odontologists, forensic anthropologists, and analysts. And we're, like I said, we're scheduled throughout the United States. Most of us have a very broad footprint for our response area that we respond to local agency calls for service or for assistance. And then the best part about this organization for me is that if I have an issue that comes up, like a child's jawbone, unfortunately, is found someplace, I have a direct resource of forensic odontologist I go to directly, and that answer comes within 5 to 10 minutes. So
wow.
It's not
wow, that's
a,
quick.
It's not a matter of having to go to send it to a lab and all those types of activities. So and this is a group I'm extremely proud to be part of. My interest was in working cold cases in retirement, and I came across NCMEC, and I could not believe the professionals that I met through this association. So it's our 20th anniversary. We're excited to be here. We actually have some Team Atom members that were original Team Atom members that are search and rescue experts, and they are phenomenal. And the one thing that I appreciate about my fellow TACs, we're called as Team Atom consultants, is that they're available 24/7. So it's not uncommon for me to make a phone call at 5 a.m. to a TAC saying, hey, you are listed as an expert in disposal site searches. I have an agency that's asking some questions that I can't answer. Can you help us out? Can we marry up the phone calls or marry up the FaceTime calls for that? So we're really excited. It's a growing organization. Team Atom is a growing organization. We grow very slowly, but very carefully because we're looking for people that have a specific job orientation and specific skills that combined with everybody else creates this beautiful stew of fantastic people that are willing to do anything for anybody else. Mm-hmm. And
are these people all retired or?
They are.
They okay.
Are. They're all retired.
Can you be on it if you're not retired?
You can, but
your flexibility
unfortunately, flexibility is a problem.
Yeah.
And NCMEC's really careful about making sure that we don't create a problem for family or create a problem for somebody's occupation. But the one of the things I really appreciate about it is that we have, as our organizations, we have official mottos, but our motto for Team Adam, our unofficial motto, is "You call, we haul."
Yeah,
and that's really exciting because if I have a case involving Indian country where there's a missing child that may be involved in a non-parental abduction situation, I call my Indian expert who knows who to call to make sure that I don't have any problems when we start interviewing people.
Sure. So what is the process if a child is missing? Run through that. How is it that you get involved with that?
We usually get involved when law enforcement contacts us.
Okay.
So, like, for example, here in Shasta County, the detectives know who I am. They know how to get a hold of me, and we communicate back and forth, and we also attend some of the same trainings. So there's face-to-face knowledge as far as that goes. But also when there's a missing case and law enforcement contacts NCMEC will offer our services. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just a matter of phone call where I call the agency and say, hey, you reported this person missing. Here's the resources that I have readily available. These are the resources that are standing by for you. I just need some notice in order to get those resources going.
So they've got a phone number that law enforcement would call. Depending on where it is, they would dispatch the experts from that area or inform them and let them take it from there. Is that how it's?
Yes. A little bit more complicated than that. There's an initial report made and a case manager is assigned in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And that case manager will reach out to one of us if they think it's something that Team Adam should get involved in.
Okay.
Then there's the unofficial way. And you know how business is done. You have the official way of doing business, the unofficial way of business.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you very safely that for every official call I get from Arlington, Virginia, I probably get 25 calls from local agencies saying, hey, Skins, let me run this by you. Is this something you guys can help with, or is this something that we should even be involved with?
Yeah. It's nice to have somebody local you can call because you know them and you're going to get the information probably quicker.
It is.
Yeah.
And then I can be deployed even quicker because I know the deployment phone call is coming and I've already spoke with the investigator. So it's kind of a roundabout communication system.
Right. Well, that's good.
You want to talk about anything in your missing event? Recent missing event?
I do.
It's on the list.
I know it's on the list. I think I put it on there.
In really big print, thanks.
I did. I had the privilege to participate in a Missing in California event on the 7th of October at California State University, Sacramento. And this event was sponsored by the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department and the Missing Unidentified Persons section of Department of Justice. I wasn't sure what to expect. I knew we were going to put up a display. I knew that we had tables and we had information for people who have lost children that haven't been recovered. But I wasn't sure what was going to happen. When I arrived, I was pleasantly shocked, surprised, and ultimately pleased. We had 65 police detectives from different departments there.
Wow.
All online with their own departments. There were people there from other law enforcement organizations and DNA laboratories, and there were people there from the court process. We were there. NCMEC was there, along with NAMIS, and we'll talk about NAMIS in a few minutes. DOJ MUPS, which is the Department of Justice Missing and Unidentified Persons. The group out of Oregon you've probably read about that will check waterways for missing children and missing adults that don't charge any money for this. They just do it gratis. They were there. CHP NTRAC was there, which is the portion of CHP that puts out the amber alerts, the silver alerts, those alerts that you see was there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purpose of the event was that families of missing children or missing adults could come in and either report them missing, which I kind of raised an eyebrow when I heard that. I thought, you mean people don't
just like walk in?
Yeah.
It turns out that's true. There were several reports of people that were missing that had never been either through a family miscommunication or some other type of of glitch in the family structure.
So it never been probably would have been primarily adults that were missing.
That particular category. And then we had families that were going to be coming in that wanted updates on the cases involving children to see what had been done. And those law enforcement organizations who were present had those cold cases with them and was able to update them and give them some information on what had taken place. They wanted updates. If they wanted information, they could get updates on where we stand now from a technological standpoint. You know, we're collecting all kinds of biometrics now. Before, it was just fingerprints. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at DNA. Now we're looking at mitochondrial DNA. And this, it seems like every month or so we get a new breakthrough. And so some of those old cases need to be reviewed again and taken a look at. So families were encouraging. A particular note, my partner in Sacramento had asked that NetMec produce a poster of the missing children, long-term missing cases in California. And so we had a poster of that, and it was quite a large poster. And we had families coming up, touching the child's picture. And just weeping.
Yeah.
Because they knew nothing about the status of their child.
Right.
They just knew their child was missing, and it was a long-term case.
What's considered, I mean, everything's long-term when your child's missing, but when you say long-term, what are you talking? How many years?
Well, let me go to my notes.
Oh.
So usually any case that's over 326 days will classify as long-term. So this event was unbelievably powerful. The investigators left renewed. Felt like they had been there, and it was a good event. And they, through acting with other investigators and running cases by other investigators, they came up with new ideas. I would see investigators talking with each other and then stopping, grabbing their notebook, and frantically writing something down. We had investigators come up to us and ask us questions about GPR. You know, do you have access to ground penetrating radar? Do you know agencies that have used it? Do you know where we can get it, where we can rent it? Will you pay for that service?
Great question.
It was a great, great day, and I left there just feeling like, wow, it was worth the drive.
That's awesome, because you would think it might be, you know, kind of feel like you were the speed bag.
Yeah. But it was an amazing event, and it was put together. And this is going to be something that they'll probably be doing either on an annual or every other year basis. But what a great event! Everything that happens that happened at that event had a follow up attached to it somehow.
So it wasn't just like we brought everybody in, told them, hey, we're still looking, and just sent them all home.
No, it wasn't like that at all.
That's really nice because you would think, like, I don't know. I mean, if these are really, you know, super long-term cases. We have to take a quick break here. Our clocks are all different. We haven't even had the time change yet, and yet all the clocks in here are different. And I just want you to know it's not me. You seem to, right, Bill? Oh, wait. That's it. Bill thought a cat was a child, so forget that.
It was a big cat. It had a white coat on.
A super big cat. A white furry face, too. He's not qualified for Team Adam, is he? That's a disqualifier?
Just a little bit of training.
He's more than qualified, yes.
Oh, my gosh. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Double wide quick stop, midnight tea top, Jack in her cherry coat town. Mama and daddy put their roots right here, cause this is where the car broke down. Yellow dog school bus, kicking up red bus, picking us up by a barbed wire fence. MTV on the RCA, no AC in the vents. We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to L.A. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a kiss. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, Uptown, Down Home, American Kids. Growing up in little pink houses, making...
Hi, this this is James Brown, soul brother number one, always fighting. Now I'm fighting for your life. I'm fighting for your life because if you use drugs, you better leave it alone. Drugs are contagious. They're killers. Every drug is a killer. Stay away from drugs. Drugs will take your life away. And if you want to live, stay away from drugs. Because they are super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad.
That's why they came to the event.
That's
why they came to the event.
And that's why the investigators came to the event.
Yeah.
The investigators, and so just so your audience understands, when you hear the phrase, a cold missing case involving a child, what that really means is a case where all investigative leads have been vetted, but somebody still has that case. And that somebody is usually the missing persons investigator who has already read that case from cover to cover and is poised like a lion ready to
count. Yeah, because they basically just have to wait for new information.
Yes, information or technology or a call from the prison system saying, hey, so-and-so is
confessing. Or somebody has to mention something and it's like, hey, wait a second. That sounds like, you know, somebody gets arrested for something else or somebody's a witness in something else and –
And you have people that always want to negotiate with the government and try to get cases reduced.
Oh, that's true, too.
And so for that, they want to offer information. So there's really no such thing as a cold case, but that's a media representation.
Sure.
Somebody owns that case in that police department.
You said on the break there was one case, the guy was the eighth investigator?
Yes. Yeah. One of the investigators I talked to, I took a look and I saw that he had a large file box, a banker's file box. And I said, man, that looks like an extensive case. And he goes, dude, that is one of six boxes. And I said, you've read them all? And he says, oh, yeah, I've read them all. I dream about them.
No. Well, the other seven people are still dreaming about them.
The first seven guys are probably still thinking of it.
Yeah. And he says, I've had to go back and re-interview or interview those other investigators to say, did you consider DNA at the time, and the answer is DNA what? We had no idea what DNA was when this investigation started. So it's a tough situation. But like I said, these people and I left from there invigorated about what we're doing and the fact that we are making inroads. It seems like every week we're seeing another cold case that's been made by DNA, which is great. Now that we're looking at mitochondrial DNA and how we can get those samples from mitochondrial DNA, you'll see that will start to amplify a little bit more.
Now, do you have a list, like if you're going to run mitochondrial, is there a set list of companies that are signed up to provide that information, or do you have to contact every one of them every time to send that DNA out or look for it, I should say?
Well, once DNA is examined, it's coded. Mm-hmm. And so that coding remains static.
Right.
So it's not like it has to be reexamined each time.
But you have to inform these DNA companies that, hey, can we search your data bank?
What you mean.
Yeah.
Those companies are amazing. Their whole direction is we will do anything we can to solve a missing child case.
Right.
And so on those occasions where their legal department says, gee, we prefer a search warrant or a subpoena.
Right.
No problem. No problem. Because you're not invading anybody's personal space.
Right.
You're just asking for records. And so it's great. And I was sharing with Aaron at the break. As a result of that question about the ground-penetrating radar, there were several people that I was able to invite to a one-hour class that we did online on GPR. And it was a great class, and everybody really felt like they understood both the strengths and limitations of using GPR for trying to locate either a clandestine gravesite or a place where somebody may have discarded something of value.
And are there law enforcement agencies that have the equipment to do that, or is there, you have to contact somebody, a private company or whatever?
There are law enforcement organizations that do that. The FBI does that. Department of Justice does that. The larger police departments, LAPD, LASO, will do that. Fortunately for us here in the North State, look at all the electrical work we have done up here all the time.
Oh, yeah, by tons.
PG&E, and PG&E's got a huge GPR program, and PG&E is always willing to help out local issues, especially involving those involving
your child. You look at how much that's true in all these you know, it's not just in the city areas. It's actually mostly in remote areas they're, you know, our rural areas where they're putting in fiber optics and all that stuff.
Yeah, call before
you guys ever
get
lucky on that?
Yeah.
On ground penetrating radar?
Yeah. I mean, do they ever find stuff while they're doing all that? I never even thought about that.
Oh, doing the work. Utility work?
Every so often we'll come across, but it's usually a native artifact of some sort or another.
Oh, okay.
That happens.
Where they kind of go, hey, we found something we didn't know about.
But we will not initiate a GPR investigation until we have something that kind of points to that area of concern. So if you want, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
So a gentleman in what's Grass Valley? Is that El Dorado County? Ooh. No, Nevada County. A gentleman in Nevada County is a primary suspect in the disappearance of a 12-year-old female that he was having sexual relations with. The day after she disappeared, he poured a patio in his backyard.
We're all going, okay.
Well, you're
going
to go, again.
Oh, okay.
Patio depth usually is 4 to 6 inches, maybe with a gravel, another 2 inches. This patio depth is 16 inches deep.
Holy mackerel.
And it's got an 8-inch gravel bed underneath it. Why?
Well, I was going to say, what type of patio do you need for that?
Parking on it, a tank?
Yeah, and all it is just a patio. So it's those types of things, those types of investigations, once information is developed, that makes the detective go, whoa, wait a minute. Something's amiss here. I think I want to look underneath here.
What is the maximum depth on that, I mean, that they can see?
I don't know. They were showing us demonstrations of using it on roadways as it approaches a bridge, and they were down 8 feet. Looking at bedrock.
No
so
kidding.
It's kind of interesting, yeah. But,
and what's it? What's it? I know this is like a something better to see than to explain. But what's it look like?
Does it look like a negative or a radar?
I mean, like when you look at like a because what I was picturing, like when you look at a brain scan, like your a scan on your brain kind of looks like your brain sort of looks like asphalt. It's kind of the gray color of asphalt. And where there are spaces, like people who have some kind of a dementia or something, there are holes, and they're the wrong color.
So, okay, your description's right on.
It'll show
a void. There'll be a void. So you'll have a static look.
Yep.
Depending on the soil, or depending on the gravel, or depending on the cement, you'll have a static look, static, 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 and all of a sudden, there's a void.
Yeah.
You know, how do we explain this void? And there's all kinds of explanations for a void.
Right.
But Why is there a void?
Can you
there?
See a thing?
No.
So you don't see a thing?
No.
It's not like you're looking. Oh, look, there's a skull right there.
Yeah, it's just lines that all of a sudden have a different pattern.
Just a void.
Just a different, okay.
Yeah. So
that's what I wondered, because otherwise it sounds like, well, hey, we should just put that everywhere and we'd find all sorts of stuff.
I'll tell you, we got involved in like a 4-hour discussion, online discussion, after we completed this 1-hour tutorial on it. Going back and forth, going, oh my God, this is so cool. And, you know, has anybody seen this actually work? And how does it manifest itself? And what type of machinery is used? And how big can you go, or how small can you go looking at this kind of thing? So it was a great class. The point is, as a result of that day, we were able to get these investigators into that class with us. Uh-huh. And so now we all have the same level of understanding of GPR and its purpose.
Because it's all about that. It's all about the team.
Oh, it is.
So I would imagine a lot of these old case files, the old cold case, they probably didn't have GPR back then, just like they didn't have a lot of the DNA studies back then. Now they can go back, and if the depression was there, I mean, if there was something there for years and years and years and years, it's still going to show up on that radar, right?
It is, yeah. Great tool. Cool. Yeah. Excellent tool. So we were talking earlier about what are the statistics in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, we have more than 600,000 people go missing per year. That includes both adults and juveniles.
How many?
600,000. And that is a lot.
Is there a time of year? I mean, do we have like a missing season?
No.
Because
there's so many reasons people go missing.
You know,
there's the voluntary missing. There's, you know, of course, the homicide victims and that type of thing.
Alien abduction.
Alien abduction, sure, that happens.
Yeah, children look like cats.
Zombies.
Children being converted into cats.
The other thing that keeps law enforcement busy is there's each year there's more than 4,400 unidentified bodies that turn up. This can be a body that's found in a field. It can be
– That's a lot.
It is a lot. Some are homicide victims. Some are suicide
victims.
So
what do they do? If they're unidentified, they enter their DNA into the system and then maybe down the road
– Exactly.
It'll match
exactly.
something?
They're unidentified at the time they're discovered, but they start going through the process. Do they have identification on them?
Where are they?
Can we run fingerprints on them? You know, who knows this person? Right. And that's the beauty of local law enforcement. Local law enforcement, a lot of times, will look at the person and go, well, that's so-and-so.
Now
they become in that identified section. But when they stay unidentified, that's where groups like MUPS, the Missing Unidentified Persons Section of Department of Justice, and NAMIS, who mostly deals with those cases that have already gone to the coroner's offices that are unidentified, that's where they jump in and they start doing tattoo analysis and they start looking at teeth and they start looking at bone structure and they start looking at piercings and all those types of things and start comparing those records against jail intake records, prison intake records, any other organization unbelievable.
Just, yeah.
And probably the coolest people ever that solve so many cases at DOJ MUPS are the analysts, the people that are sitting in front of the computer, and they're calling law enforcement agency constantly going, hey, we got your John Doe identified. He is so-and-so out of such and such a place, and here's his identifiers.
Right. Now you've got a direction to go as far as finding out what happened to him.
Yes. Now there's a direction, because if you don't know who the person is,
there's
no direction.
Yeah.
So I'm curious though, like with those people. Okay, so when someone goes, somebody's gone, right? Are you taking DNA from like this? Does the family bring you the hairbrush and stuff like that? Do you put that on file at the time when somebody is missing? Is there a time period where that becomes part of the record?
There is, and I'm glad you asked that question. I think it's on your list.
Oh, it is. Sorry, I didn't read the list.
If it isn't, I neglected to put it on there. So under the way things used to be done.
Oh, no, I just thought of it. It's not on the list.
The way things used to be done, information was golden. Whatever information was presented by the family was considered truthful and taken down. And so that was just the way it was. And that was a societal issue. And as time has gone by and we now have analytical issues where we can collect biometrics and confirm information, confirm statements. It's changed everything. And so it's not uncommon on a missing child case for law enforcement to come into the living arrangement or living area of the child and collect hairbrush, toothbrush, the child's toys, those types of things for DNA analysis, where before that was never done. Before, because it wasn't even known really.
Well, that it would ever come into play.
Yeah. The other thing that you'll see now is a complete search of the living house, of the house itself. Complete search, because too many children have been found either alive and hiding someplace in the house after they've called in a bunch of resources to do a house-by-house check. Or, unfortunately, some children have been found deceased in the house, and that it was either an accidental death or it was a homicide, and the child was being hidden from law enforcement. So there's been some changes in that. A missing child case is investigated very deeply, very thoroughly.
So, time is going so fast today. All right, we've got to take a really quick break. A lot of questions. Bill, you have a lot of questions still?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we've got a lot of questions still.
I'm hanging fire.
Our guest is Paul Skinner. He is with Team Adam from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And you are listening to We the People. You can find this at wethepeopleradio.us.
But the good news is there's angels everywhere out on the street, holding out a hand to pull you back up on your feet. The ones that you've been dragging for so long, you're on your knees, you might as well be praying. Guess what I'm saying, if you're going through hell, keep on going, don't slow down. If you're scared, don't show it, you might get out, or the devil even knows you're there.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. In a recent court case, Freed versus Garland, it was determined both medical and recreational marijuana users have no right to firearms, because marijuana use was associated with elevated risky decision-making. It is beyond dispute that marijuana users experience altered mental states that affect their judgment, creating irrational and unpredictable behavior. There is a clear relationship between the bevy of recent active shooters and marijuana use. Remember, let's be careful out there.
What's the problem? What's the question? What's the answer? Where's this heading? You keep talking, but where's it going?
There's an answer, I don't know it. Please, you're killing me. Please, you're killing me with all these questions.
That's appropriate.
We know that's what you were thinking.
How did you read my mind?
I like snuck up on you there, didn't it? The perfect tagline.
That was good.
Yeah, killing me with all these questions.
That was really good.
Yeah, at the break, we were talking about was it FBI lab or Department of Justice lab? We have one in Reading.
We do. We are really fortunate. Department of Justice in California is phenomenal, and their working attitude with local agencies is basically, what can we do to serve you? Mm-hmm. So they do everything from alcohol analysis, blood alcohol analysis, fingerprint examinations.
They've got to be just as busy as every other lab, too. I imagine
they are. And I was talking to one of their lab people at that event in Sacramento, and I said, so how are you guys doing? She goes, we're doing great. Pause one.
And
we're doing greater if we had 30 more criminalists.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the big issue is a lot of young people are not interested in going into the scientific part of the criminal justice system. And so
you would think that would be big, though.
Oh, you would.
You would think we would be having a nerd fest right now.
Are they actually looking for people to fill those positions?
Constantly. They're actually recruiting in the science departments at the universities. And to work with these people from Department of Justice is a treat you just can't believe, because they are willing to share their knowledge with you. There is no I don't know, in your industry, if you had those people that wouldn't share.
Yeah, the secret squirrel people.
Yeah, they just don't share. No, the Department of Justice MUPS, they'll share everything. They put on trainings all the time. I usually get asked to come to their trainings and spend about an hour talking about what NECMEC and specifically Team Adam can do for the investigators. And that's a time where I see people really taking notes, because when I walk in and say, I'm going to give you something that's free of charge, and I'm going to supplement your staffing on that investigation.
Mm. Yeah.
They pick up their pen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Are those analysts, do you find that they find it a very rewarding job, or is it something that just has a lot of frustration attached to it?
In this field, there's two branches of analysts. There's crime analysts that take a look at crimes, when they occur, how they occur. And that group is trying to get into the spatial issue of why criminals go a certain direction when they offend, when they don't offend. On the other side, you have the investigative analysts. And those are the people that if you gave them a shovel, they would just keep digging that hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And so here's an example. We had one person we were looking at. We got a hold of our analyst back in Arlington, and she started looking at open source information on that particular person, everything that's on the internet. And then she kept calling me back saying, I think I can go to this group and find out this information. I think I can do some more on this.
Yeah.
I think he isn't who he says he is. I think he's actually this person who is wanted out of Sudan for a child violation.
I would imagine a lot of that just comes from experience.
Exactly.
I ran into it before. This is what we found.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, we love to call them the cops without the guns because they are they're behind the computer screen. And if you've ever watched, I was trying to get the name of the show.
Criminal Minds, where they play
snazzy
music and then they figure the case out in 5 minutes?
Yes, Minds. You've ever watched Criminal Minds and you see, I can't remember her name, but she's like this magician with the computer and she knows everything.
Oh, yeah.
That's what investigative analysts are. They are amazing. Now, they don't come across the same information that she portrays on the TV show, because there's a privacy issue with a lot of stuff, but they're the unsung heroes. They're in the background, and they're in the background, but they step forward and they hand you the platter, and you look in the platter and go, "Oh my God!"
Well, because you can't prove what I mean. Even if you have found something, you can't prove it until they verify it. I mean, they give you the proof to use to go identify the child, the grown up, to identify the perpetrator of the crime. I mean, those are the guys who give you the
nexus.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a nexus between the offense, the victim, and the perpetrator or the suspect in that case. Mm-hmm. And we, meaning the traditional law enforcement model, try to make that nexus through statements or statements that are incorrect or the old LLPOF adage, liar, liar, pants on fire.
Is that like the Sodi defense?
It's like the Sodi defense, yes. Some other dude did it. So the traditional law enforcement model is you do that through interviews, through process of interviews, and you either prove something happened or prove it didn't happen or prove what they said is not true. The analyst proves beyond a shadow of a doubt this occurred and there is a nexus between the victim and the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And so they are the unsung heroes of missing persons cases.
Now, is it true that eyewitness information a lot of times is not very reliable or not accurate?
Eyewitness information is subject to the me bias. And the me bias is what I see confirms what I think. What I think confirms what I think I saw. And so and it also deals with background. Mm-hmm. So here's an example. I recall one time as a young police officer, a lady had her purse stolen from her while walking out of a supermarket. And she says to me, I said, "So can you tell me what he looked like?" And she said, "Absolutely, it was a boy."
That narrows it down.
Okay, so what makes you say that? She goes, "He was short." Okay, we're good. And you can see where we're going with this investigation. Yeah. This is not going well, and we're going to have a problem. Versus a woman who reported the same type of event at the same store 2 days later, telling me that he was wearing a New York Yankees ball jersey. He was 5'8". His hair was closely cropped on the sides but real long on the front and was down in front of his face. And he had a Pac-Man belt buckle on.
Boom.
Which makes me want to say, tell me more.
Yeah.
Why do you know about Pac-Man? And she says, "Oh, I have a 5-year-old son. He plays Pac-Man. And my husband loves the Yankees. And so, therefore, I'm supposed to love the Yankees." So a lot of the a lot of the problems that we have with eyewitness stuff, it depends on their orientation.
Right.
You know, what their background is and their ability to verbalize what they saw and the fact that they just went through a traumatic experience. Hmm. You know, if you ask, my sister crashed my car one time and I said, how much damage was done to the car? And she goes, I don't know. Well, how long were you out there? About an hour. My goodness, you didn't see how much damage? No, I didn't. I didn't really see. So, eyewitnesses are great. Juries don't like eyewitnesses because of that.
Right.
Juries prefer, it's a CSI effect now. You know, as soon as CSI came out on TV,
yeah,
then all investigators throughout the world rolled their eyes and went, oh my God, now we're going to have proof beyond a living shadow of a doubt, no matter what. And it made us better. And so now we're using things like DNA, mitochondrial DNA, touch DNA, and those concepts that never been heard of or thought of during the 70s and 80s.
Wow. Well, and so the spoiler alert, in the future, at some point, we're going to talk about no-body homicides, since that is your field of expertise. And you see those on TV sometimes. You know, they're going to prosecute somebody for a crime when they don't have anything. But mm-hmm. I'm super curious how that works. But we won't.
I can give you 1 minute.
Okay.
Okay. Imagine this.
Would you believe?
Yeah. I remember that cartoon. So there's a lot of talk about circumstantial versus real evidence. And circumstantial evidence is placed on a lower rung of the ladder than real evidence. And yet we deal with circumstantial evidence every day. If it's raining outside, you look outside, you go, it's raining.
You don't really need to go out and
nobody
get in
had
it.
To prove to you that it's raining. So I offer you this. If you wake up in the morning and there's snow on the ground, then circumstantially, your brain says, it snowed. Now, is there a possibility that a movie production company came into your town and coated everything with snow throughout the night, and now there's snow every place in the ground? Maybe. But is that reality?
Yeah.
And so with no-body homicide cases, if there is a known suspect and your victim was last seen with your suspect and that victim no longer exists, either on paper, DMV records, nobody's seen him or her, no longer exists, then when that's produced to the jury, then the jury looks at the other attorney and says, what's your explanation? So the explanation has to be that victim is still alive, but we don't know where they are, or Sody.
Mm-hmm.
Some other dude did it.
Yeah.
And as soon as they claim Sody, then the jury's going to want to say or want to hear, who is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So if it was another guy, tell me, who is it? If you can't tell me who is it, then we need to talk about the guy who's sitting next to you at the table. So that's the basic premise of no-body homicide cases, is that there are those cases, they're few and far between, that we will go ahead and push forward.
You have enough.
And yes, and go ahead and push forward and let the jury make that decision as to whether or not they think he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And by doing so, that circumstantial evidence layer that we always felt was down here comes back even with eyewitness or real evidence case. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of no-body homicide cases.
It's kind of great because you think, all right, that takes away there is the perfect crime, right? The perfect crime is you never find the body, and it's like, well, that's not the perfect crime. If you have people who are really dogged at being able to prove that, you know, you were last holding the string.
Enough pieces that all point in the same direction.
And I will tell you that nationwide we're looking at right around 87% conviction rate.
Of the no-body homicide?
No-body homicide cases.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Wow.
87, which is high. Really,
that's
really
huge.
High. Because you have the ambiguity of humans on the jury. So you can have one jury member say, you know, I'm not too sure. I don't feel comfortable convicting on something like this. But 87% is really high. Now, it takes a really qualified expert to put a case on like that.
Sure.
And we got them in Shasta County.
Yeah?
We got them.
So they can roll those kind of cases?
They can roll those kind of cases. And they are super, super talented, and they know their stuff. And they will take a case on in a minute that has those prescriptives in it that allows us to go forward with a no-body case.
Interesting.
Well, it's like when people disappear, a woman disappears, and she has kids, and kids were everything in her life, and the story is she took off and left the kids and never seen again. Not probable.
Foul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not likely.
Yeah, you hear that stuff, and you go, well, that's not a thing.
You've heard of Occam's razor.
Yes.
Occam's razor. The explanation, whatever is the easiest explanation.
Yep.
Among all the other explanations, is probably the one that works,
right.
One that fits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. We don't need to invent some convoluted thing. That's
no.
Yeah. So, all right. So we haven't looked at all right on my list. What's on your list, Bill?
Oh, I got a lot.
Paul, what's on your list? Mm-hmm. Okay, because I'm looking at, and we've got like like a half a minute. So you want to tell them what we're going to talk about when we come back?
When we come back, we're going to talk about the four areas that NCMEC, specifically Team Adam, concentrates on, including endangered runaways, long-term missing, family abductions, and infant abductions. And we'll do just a brief introduction to each of those categories real fast.
Infant abductions. Those people, we've got a special place for them, I think.
I know.
We have a special place for all these people, don't we? Yes. Well, we'll ponder that while we listen to the news, where we have more specialness coming, I'm sure. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Switched it up on you. Good afternoon. And good afternoon. And good afternoon.
You're really good.
You know how many there are, of me there are. No, it was already, the show was already preloaded. Poor Christina can't shut us off, so she's flashing us the sorry sign. It's not her. They programmed in a show for this week, but we were here in real life. So real us is having a hard time overwhelming fake us. Mm. Bill, since you're live here today, what do you got for us?
Well, we have a sponsor. our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. So if you're looking for a new mower, a rider, a zero turn, whatever it is, go up and see them. If you're looking for a new tractor, implements, repairs on your tractor, give them a call. Their number is 530-226-9226, and they're located up at on Twin View Boulevard, just south of Phil's Propeller, 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and they can take care of all your tractor needs up there. So either give them a call or catch them on the interweb at papemachinery.com.
Bill and his interweb.
I know you like that. That's why
I wasn't sure what that was.
It is. It's not a thing. It's Bill's okay. Bill's special fantasy. It's that right in there with children that look like large white cats.
Yeah.
There's something, some sort of a gear he's slipped. Bill's running in a parallel universe. It's all those shows about the unexplained that he watches.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I'm just a contrary.
He's,
okay.
He's channeling William Shatner.
Well, that's what we're going to find out.
That's exactly how he does it, too. Good job, Bill, actually. Yeah. He's old. They might need a replacement.
Yeah, never know.
Got a future. So back to the serious topic at hand, actually. So our guest is Paul Skinner, and we are doing a third in a series here with the regarding the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Mr. Skinner is on Team Adam, and we have done a focus on the exploitation of children. We've also done an overview of the National Center, and we did that in August, did another one in September. Here we are in October, following up with missing children. You hear about it all the time. You know, I mean, it's become kind of a thing. Like, remember when they first started putting kids on milk cartons? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, now they're, I mean, honestly, you couldn't find anybody who, if you said kid on a milk carton, everybody knows what that means. Everyone knows what that means. Do they even still do that, though?
No.
Nobody even has milk cartons anymore.
They don't have milk cartons.
Yeah, there's no milk cartons, right? They're all in those plastic jugs. Kind of screwed you guys over there for advertising.
They did.
Okay, so where do you want to go this hour? We had a five-minute break. I already forgot.
Oh, okay.
Short attention span theater, like, caught up with me.
What I'd like to do is make sure the listening audience understands that we take a look at missing children in four separate categories. And I want to talk about each category just briefly and talk about some risk factors that your listening audience should be aware of that may come up. The first one is endangered runaways. At NCMEC, we believe that every runaway is endangered because they have the potential to be exposed to so many things while they're on the run. This is usually children that are under 18 that are missing on their own accord, and their whereabouts are unknown. They're usually on their own or with a group or coupled up. And this is an interesting phenomenon because we're seeing a drop in coupled up folks running away together, the Romeo and Juliet syndrome, we call it. We have seen one of those cases in the North State in the last 6 months. So that's kind of an interesting note because if they were to had taken statistics back in 1800s when I was a teenager, there would have been a lot of coupled up Romeo and Juliet type situations where people had just ran away because they wanted to be with each other for the rest of their life. But the risk factors are important, and they pop up usually as physical or sexual abuse in the home or the possibility of physical or sexual abuse while they're on the run, while they're out. Sometimes there's family conflict that creates this issue. Sometimes they're struggling with mental health issues. Substance abuse comes into play. And here's the big one for us at NCMEC is pregnancy. When a pregnancy is involved, oftentimes there's usually an endangered runaway situation that will pop up for us. Online enticement is another issue where we're seeing a lot of growth as far as people, kids running away from home in order to be with X person who they just met online. Gang activity is another reason that kids are leaving their home. And social rejection and bullying right now is another growing area where kids are leaving home. Either they're dared to, or they feel like they have no choice but to leave the home environment because they brought so much shame on the home. 77% of those reported to NCMEC are between the ages of 15 and 17. So the majority of these children that are leaving are right around the driving age, but for some reason are not driving. And, Bill, you and I had talked about this a couple months ago. When we were 16, there was nothing that was going to stand in the way of us getting our driver's license. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that that's not necessarily the case.
They don't do that now.
No, it's not necessarily the case right now.
It's really weird.
And oftentimes these kids go missing just because they want to get out or they want to do something different. They're not licensed drivers and they don't have cars.
What percentage of the missing kids are kids in that age bracket? I realize that's like a question within a riddle, but I mean, when you think of, like, when most of us think of missing children, we think of little kids.
We do.
We think of little kids getting snatched from the shopping mall.
And that's 1%.
Playground or whatever.
That's 1% of all the missing kids.
It's 1%.
It's only 1%. It is. But it's something that catches our eye quickly. It's something that law enforcement responds to quickly and in abundance. And it's something we should, as a society, respond to quickly. But we still have these children that are decided on their own to leave home, leave the home environment, leave the protection of the home, and making them susceptible to other issues. It's like that poster or that missing adult flyer I was showing you before the show, where she's 23 years old, but She has some challenges, and so she operates at an 8-year-old level. So is she susceptible to
everything?
Everything.
Yes.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. And so
everything bad.
That's a huge issue. The other category that we focus on at Team Adam is long-term missing cases. And those are those cases where the viable leads have been thoroughly investigated, but the child has not been recovered. These cases are extremely frustrating to law enforcement. I spent considerable time up in Klamath Falls last year dealing with several cases where once we reviewed the case and read all the police reports and all the leads that came in on that case, it was clear who the suspect was, but the suspect and the victim were never connected in any way. So it didn't get us over that nobody homicide hump that we needed. And so children that are reported to NCMEC are usually recovered after a brief period of time. I don't know if you remember as a child if you ever ran away, but my son ran away and he ran out to the camper out in the driveway and hid underneath the camper for a while until my wife told him she was fixing something for dinner that was his favorite. And then he forgave us and decided not to run away, and he came back in with his Tonka truck and always forget.
That was the end of that.
Yeah, that was the end of that.
Didn't you run away and then weren't allowed to cross the street?
Yeah, I got to the corner and it was like, I'm boxed in here. I can't cross the street. I have to go home.
Yeah. Living on the wild side.
Yeah, right.
Feels dangerous.
Good little rule follower.
So on those long-term cases, we invite law enforcement to call us and ask us to come in and do a third-party review of not only the case, the information presented in the case, but also to see where that case stands as far as today's technology goes. A lot of these cases, I reviewed one last year that was done in carbon with carbon paper. Typed on a typewriter. IBM Selectric.
Oh, old enough to...
With carbon paper.
What am I saying? I used to use carbon paper. Old enough.
Yeah. And, of course, now we have a different technology today, and we offer them the use of technology to scan that information and to put it into programs like Adobe Publisher and those types of programs that will bring everything back up to today's standard. Now, at some point, if this case continues the way it is and no new information is provided or new information comes in and dribs and drabbles, we're going to have to revisit that same case again and take a look at it from a technology standpoint. So technology is one of the things we look at. The other thing we look at is the evidence that was taken. We've been to some organizations where one piece of evidence was taken. We've been to others where they have an entire dedicated room locked up, has been locked up for 15 years, that has everything that child ever had in its room, in that room, which is fabulous for us because we can look at that and say we need to take a look at touch DNA. We also do age progression. So when we have usually about anniversary dates of the abduction or the missing, NCMEC will do computer-enhanced age progression. And usually on the anniversary date, we'll do something as far as press goes, a media release, or we've been using Facebook a lot. And so you'll see pushes, we call them pushes from NCMEC, saying, this is so-and-so, she disappeared on this date, this time, this is what she looks like now as a 27-year-old or a 32-year-old person. Some of those have really worked out well, but the success rate is below 10% on those. But it's still something we've got to do because we know that everything changes with time. In fact, right. We were talking about that at break. We know that everything changes with time, and with the equipment that we have that local law enforcement doesn't have, we can actually progress that person through the different ages and then produce that. The third area is family abductions, and this is by far the biggest one in the U.S. because relationships change. People like, people don't like, people are mad, people hate, people love. You have that whole human dynamic that goes back and forth, back and forth. And unfortunately, children are used sometimes as leverage against the other person, or they're used as a bargaining tool for the other person. Oftentimes, the child is actually just flat abducted. So,
what's the percentage of child abductions that are family members?
You know, I would have to say probably right around 60%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very really really high.
That's why they always look at family members first.
Yeah.
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 And so there's risk factors involved there, and among those is that if the parent or the other family member has previously abducted or threatened to abduct the child, that's a huge risk factor that we look at. Mm-hmm. Whether there's been a history of mental instability or a lack of cooperation or even violence in the past, we take a look at their criminal history. I'm not talking about law enforcement, not NCMEC, because NCMEC doesn't have access to criminal history stuff. But law enforcement takes a look at criminal history. We take a look at, through open sources, as to where their strongest connection is. Is their strongest connection with whatever country they came from, fill in the blank, or whatever state they came from, fill in the blank, or whatever region, fill in the blank, because that's a good indicator that they don't plan on staying within the jurisdiction of the court, even if they have the child.
Right.
No job, but or the ability to work anywhere they choose, so they have a tangible talent that will employ them. If they're financially independent or supplemented by somebody else, and who is that provider? If they're engaged in planning activities such as quitting a job, selling a house, changing work, or closing accounts. If they're hiding or destroying documents, applying for travel documents, or if they're asking the spouse or the other parent for copies of birth certificates and or school records.
Yeah, huge red flag.
Huge risk indicators. Huge, huge.
Yeah.
So there's some preventative steps that can be taken by folks that are involved in this type of situation or may think they might get involved in it. The first one is make sure you got that custody order. That custody order is so, so important from the court. There were so many times I would get a call like this, and I would ask, can I see your custody order? And the answer would be, we didn't think we needed one because we were getting along. Obviously not.
Right.
Obviously not. He's taken your child. During that process, request that the judge include abduction prevention measures in the court order so that the parent or the family member is advised in advance. This is what we're looking at, and you're not going to be doing the following things. One other step that you can do for preventative issues is to surrender the child's passport to the court itself. Walk in and have the judge the child's passport. And that will keep the child from traveling. And that passport gets turned over to the State Department. State Department issues a no-travel order for that particular person. So if they're at an airport and they try to get through without passport, father identifies the child as so-and-so, they'll actually run that name. The name will come up as a no-travel.
Is there an age limit on passports?
Just wondering that.
I don't know.
You know, I've never heard of that, but somebody walks into an airport with a small child, and I would imagine most people assume it's their kid. Do they ask for some kind of photo identification or a passport?
You'd have to.
I would assume so.
Otherwise, we'd have kids. Yeah.
But Bill, my passport says Hawaii, Alaska, and Berkeley on it. It doesn't. Yeah. I don't go anywhere like that.
Right.
So I haven't experienced that. So I would assume that they would check for that kind of thing.
Well, I know that kids' passports are a shorter renewal term, obviously, because their features change so often. Hmm. So I think it's a 5-year.
Okay.
But I don't know when the 5-year deal begins. But like babies, right? They're going to take a baby out of the country. I hate to say this, but babies kind of look like babies.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess if they're your baby, they look different. But
this is another one of those moments where I wish my wife was here because she remembers she remembers the length of all these.
I'll look it up.
All these passport things.
But no, but, just that. But, that's kind of interesting. That turning that in, though, that's a good precautionary thing.
Yeah.
Actually, that's smart.
One really important special note here is that a custody order is not required to report a child missing or a child abducted.
Wait, say that again?
A custody order is not required to report a child missing or abducted. This is another one of those wives' tales that mm-hmm. somehow circulated throughout communities. And you still have a right to report any child or any person missing to law enforcement, and law enforcement still has an obligation to take that report. But there actually have been attorneys that have told their clients, you don't have a court order, so you have no right to report your child as a missing person.
Oh, wow.
And you do have that right. It's your child.
And so. And the 24-hour thing, that's not a thing anymore, is
no. No, it's not. In fact, it's so broad right now that we were prepared on the, at that event at Sacramento to, if somebody were to come in and say, I need to report and walk up to a Sacramento PD investigator and say, I need to report my child missing from Los Banos, he would have taken the report. They were prepared to take the report. Mm-hmm. Now, once that report's taken, there would be a discussion between Los Banos Police Department, Sacramento Police right. Department. That's who's going to take the lead on this and who's going to still stay attached to it or not. You know, they may just turn the whole case over to, and in this case I use Los Banos, may just turn it over to Los Banos. Mm-hmm. The last area where our children are categorized in is infant abduction. And this one is the one that just, it's tough to figure out. And at the same time, it's concerning because it actually identifies the profile of the usual suspect. And so infant abductions are any abduction of a child under the year of 1 year of age. And it varies from a non-custodial parent who may be doing the abduction to a stranger. However, when we did an analysis of 337 cases, we found that the suspect was usually female of childbearing age who appeared to be pregnant. Most likely compulsive and relied on manipulation, lying, and deception. I should tell you at this point that in talking with one of the investigators from the police department, I ran these by him one day and he said, holy smoke, you just gave me a Reader's Digest on what direction to go looking for the suspect. And I said, yeah, it's not hocus pocus. It's based on previous cases. You're not profiling. Mm-hmm. You're basing it on previous information that's been vetted. The suspect usually frequently indicates that she's lost a baby or unable to have babies. Most often she's married or cohabitating. She usually lives within the community. Again, that narrows your focus.
Yeah.
Because you've got the whole world initially as a potential suspect, and now you have somebody in the community. There's usually a history, if you go backwards, that person's been in the nursery or been in the maternity ward in the past. And so that's why a lot of hospitals consider nursery and maternity ward as security areas now, which is great.
Well, there are like tons of – I mean, I think we've all seen movies and TV shows about that. That happens a lot.
It does.
We've got to take a swift break that I'm not so swift about, like 5 minutes over. I'm really kind of traveling in my own time right here today. And by the way, the State Department actually has a pretty extensive thing on there about how to prevent your children from being taken out of the country. They've got quite a bit of information on there. So this isn't secret. You know, it isn't being held as a secret. And they do say turn the passport in. So at least everybody's singing off the same song sheet, which is nice. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you can find commercial-free recording of these programs after the fact at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
This silence was brought to you by all the people who feel like there's too much sound in the world.
Yeah. I don't want to wait anymore. I just don't think I have the strength to carry on. Oh, I don't want to wait anymore. I waited so long, forgot what I'm waiting for.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know the non-native noxious weed we call marijuana is a thirsty plant? It uses up to 5 gallons of water a day in our climate. Most marijuana in California is chemically laden with pesticides, herbicides, miticides, growth hormones, and even adhesives like methacrylate used to boost pollen capture. Methacrylate? What the heck? Superglue? All this goes into the human body from unknowing users looking to get high. I call them the walking as yet undead. Remember, let's be safe out there.
We all have a face that we hide away forever, and we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone.
Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk and some are leather. They're the faces of a stranger, but we love to try them on.
Couldn't resist. Had to, I mean, lots of stranger danger out there, right?
You're amazing. I thought I did a lot of show prep. You got it down.
I didn't. I'm kind of winging it, but I like to wing it because it inspires me.
I understand.
So we were talking. You had a couple more things on infant abduction or infant.
Yeah, that's just.
I did. There's one more comment.
Thing to do.
One of the really interesting things that I find in this is that during our study, we found that the suspect spends considerable time planning the abduction,
mm-hmm.
but has no interest in a particular infant. So it's the first infant available, and then she leaves.
Wow.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
On one hand, you have all this preparation work and this pre-planning, pre-visit, maybe a couple dry runs with no idea, no concept of which infant she wants. She just wants an infant because she either has to confirm her story that she's told everybody,
mm-hmm.
or she wants that infant to actually raise and nurture and that
right,
type of thing.
Right.
So let's talk about reporting a child missing.
Yes.
Shall we? Okay. The myths are you have to wait a certain amount of time to report a child missing. That's myth number one. No.
Was that ever a thing?
It was.
Yeah,
it was a thing, right?
That'd be 24 hours.
It was a thing, and it was because of the proliferation of the runaways.
Kid under the camper.
Yeah, I'm leaving,
you
know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It was, and it was completely inappropriate. And yet some organizations kind of followed that rule. And even with adults, they would say 48 hours, 7 days, 12 days, 24 days. We need a month. People have a right to go missing. That's true. People have a right to drop out and say, you know, mm-hmm. I've had it with you guys. But with a child and with a missing person's case, law enforcement will take the report no matter what. But time is our enemy with these types of cases.
Sure.
It's not uncommon for law enforcement to get a call of a missing child 48 hours after the child was last seen. And the reason for this is because you've lost the nucleus of the family. And so the child may be at auntie's house sometimes, may be at mom and dad's house, or maybe at dad's house sometimes, and people think the child is either at school.
And they're just not paying attention.
Or at the Boys and Girls Club. You know, they're just not paying attention.
Is this runaway kids who got snatched?
Both.
Is this kind of all of it?
Yeah, all the above.
Because if they can runaway kids, you know, a good ploy would be, I'm at my friend's house, and then by the time you come back from the, quote, sleepover, wait, kid never came for the sleepover.
You know, I'm concerned about you. You just, you've used that excuse, haven't you?
I've been watching some, you know, criminal shows here.
Oh, I see. Okay. But you would have never done that as a teenager.
Actually, I never would have.
Okay.
I would have come up with a much better story.
That was the alien thing.
For God's sake, our people are Irish. We've been coming up with stories for centuries. That's
gotcha.
How we survived.
I think the other thing, too, that people need to realize is when law enforcement's called and a child is reported as missing, that investigation starts immediately. That dispatcher, that man or woman that you're talking to on the phone, is trained to elicit from you certain information. And at any point during that conversation, that dispatcher goes, ooh, the hair on my neck just
Spidey
came
sense.
Up.
Spidey sense, yeah.
Yeah, where the parent or somebody's referring to that child as has been or in the past, those types of things. That information is conveyed to law enforcement that's responding. It's also conveyed to the investigators. So these dispatchers are really talented at taking these critical calls and getting that information. There's going to be a lot of questions asked of the parent or whoever is reporting it, and you can expect a law enforcement contact. There is no such thing as calling the police and saying, I want to report my child missing, but there's no reason to come out here. We're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. We're going to be
like
out there.
Calling 911 and hanging up.
Yeah. We're not just going to be out there with one person. We're going to be out there with many people because that you just pulled the red handle. We call it the red handle in law enforcement, and that's in private sector, we call it hitting the panic button, but the red handle just got pulled, and
right.
the person calling just pulled the handle for us. At some point, there's going to be an operation that's going to take place either at the house or in the neighborhood. So can expect heavy law enforcement presence, especially if it's a child. And you can also expect in this community, in the North State, you can also expect air support. We'll be responding to that type of call looking for a lost and or abducted child. And that's not going to be a quick event. It's not going to be a 5-minute, 10-minute, 30-minute, 1-hour event. It's going to be a multi-hour event that's going to require several searches mm-hmm. of a lot of areas. And these are called hasty searches, meaning they're going to go fast and furious, and they're going to go from lot to lot to lot. And the thought process behind this is we have to find this child. We know we're up against the clock here. We also know that those people that abduct child, remember that's 1%, within 24 hours usually kill the child. So
they usually do what?
Usually kill the child. So that means when I say hasty, I'm serious. It's going to be a lot of moving parts all at once. It's not uncommon in these situations to have a command post set up in the middle of the street. I was part of that a lot in the Bay Area when we had a proliferation of young girls that had been kidnapped that never been found. And we had to set up command posts in residential neighborhoods. And unfortunately, we actually had to set up video teams to videotape those people who were watching the cops do their thing.
Oh, yeah, because they say that all the time. And it's like fire people
absolutely.
Do that, too.
Yeah, our suspect was in the group.
Wow.
Does that happen often?
I mean,
it's got to happen often enough that
it does.
I mean, the public knows about it.
As long as he's not with the victim any longer, yes, it does happen a lot because curiosity, they want to see what they've created.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in a law enforcement response? Well, obviously there's initial contact we've talked about. We've talked about the aerial search or area search, but additional resources are being called in. And so to give you an example, I was part of you may have seen the thing last year, a Rodney case out of South Lake Tahoe. And when I walked into the command post, Civil Air Patrol was present, California Highway Patrol was present, Placer County Sheriff's Department was there, Nevada County Sheriff's Department was there. FBI CART team was there. We were there. Air Force Search and Rescue was there. And the Marine Patrol divisions of 5 sheriff's departments were there.
Wow.
Now, was that the gal that got abducted by a boyfriend or something from a campsite?
Okay. This is kind of. I mean, she was at a campsite. She was at a party with a whole bunch of friends.
Okay.
She called her parents and said, I'll be home. And the travel time was going to be 15 minutes. She didn't get home. And they actually found her in her car in the bottom of that lake. But to give you an idea, I mean, this thing's going to go from zero to massive in just a few moments.
Yeah, 911, what's your issue? And then
especially
a list like that gets assembled.
Yeah, especially when the red handle gets pulled, especially when something pops up that law enforcement, either a patrol level or investigative level, says, mm-mm.
Has that always been the case? I mean, on a missing person, have they always responded that way?
It has, if something came up, you mm-hmm. know, if something popped up. Now, what could happen? Let's talk about the red flags. The first one we talked about briefly is a delay in reporting.
Yeah, somebody disappeared a week ago. Yeah.
Exactly.
You're like, okay, yeah, you did it.
It makes it, you know, your common you sense.
I'd be a terrible dispatcher. All right, you did it. Stay where you are. We're coming together.
I can hear Aaron now say, if you'd like to confess, I'm taking confessions now.
Go ahead and tell me. We're going to find out.
Yeah.
Bless you. Don't you watch TV?
Bless you, my son. I know you've sinned. Counter reports of missing persons creates a red flag. Not so much because the people came to the police department, but you want to find out why they came to the police department. Did they come to the police department because they don't want you seeing the scene?
Oh,
at the house.
Don't come and visit me at my house where I killed the person or
exactly.
I'm holding them hostage. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what's the motivation behind there? So that's one of those – another issue where the red handle gets grabbed, maybe not pulled all the way, but close. You know, we've got to take a good look at why they're saying what they're saying.
So they don't call in. They show up. You're talking about
show up.
Yeah. All right.
Where they call and say, you don't need to respond here. I just want to give you the information on my child. She's missing.
They're not going to do anything.
Please don't come
over. Don't know anything about
it.
Please don't come over.
Yeah, please don't look around here. Don't worry about the hair that's on the front porch. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
One of the first things the dispatcher is going to be doing is they're taking that information, because if you can imagine what an octopus looks like, only
more octopusy?
Only human.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
They are doing multiple tasks all the time. And so as that caller is calling, that dispatcher is doing a history check on that house to find out how many times they've been there, what types of calls they've been on, those types of things. And that information is getting sent out to...
All while the person's on the phone.
All while the person's on the phone.
Sure, wow. Sure. They We've had lots of domestic violence calls.
Absolutely. Yeah, these people do not get paid. They love to be heard, not seen.
Mm-hmm.
But they do not get paid for the value that they have, because they can set the tone of investigation very, very quickly.
I was just going to say that those types of moves would basically tell law enforcement how quickly they're going to respond.
Well, we've all heard those 911 calls where you're like, wait, why didn't you ask him this? Or the one where you go, ooh, smooth move. You know, they get all real nice with them, and then they keep them on there. You're like, oh, you are a pro.
Well, I remember when 911 first came out, and it was all new for everybody. And I remember hearing one of our dispatchers one time, a lady called up on 911. And the dispatcher says, 911 emergency, can I help you? And she goes, oh, I must have misdialed. Dispatcher said, okay, if you did, give me a number between 4 and 6. And the lady said, 7. Hang up the phone. The caller hangs up the phone. Dispatcher turns over, hits the hot tone, says, respond to an unknown disturbance at this address. And sure enough, he had a gun to her head.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty smart. That's super smart.
I love dispatchers. They're amazing.
That's a – gosh, we should find a dispatcher and have them come in and tell us stuff.
That
would be super interesting.
They are phenomenal.
I'm getting a good idea here.
There you go.
All right, we have to take a really quick break again. Sorry.
No problem.
I'm like throwing it to Christina all the time. We keep changing our time up. Sorry. So in real life, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Nice job, Bill.
And more?
And more.
Okay.
Not more, really. Less.
Didn't matter to me. I got lost walking in the valley. Well, it could have been 1993 when it goes badly after burning so bright. Trying to make sense of a hopeless situation feels like dying in the middle of the night. When it goes badly, you're alone in the darkness. Nothing's ever ever make it right.
This is Navy carrier pilot call sign 6 with a message to veterans. Local marijuana hucksters are offering free samples to veterans claiming that marijuana helps PTSD. These claims are not supported by legitimate medical studies, the VA or the FDA. Will you join me to protect our youth and our country from psychosis-inducing high-potency THC use? For the truth, please visit the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis at www.indiaalphasierraindiacharlie1.org. Thank you.
So good, but you will come to a place where the only thing you feel are loaded guns in your face, and you'll have to deal with pressure.
Yes. The dispatcher's theme song, Pressure.
Yes.
All right. So you have a snazzy list. You're going to click through with us.
I do. We were talking about some red flags on missing persons cases that would cause law enforcement to really up their game, especially in calling in additional resources. If there's some confusion as to who the reporting person is, when they are confused about what their relationship is with the missing person.
Is that a thing?
Yes, where they'll say, I'm the auntie. And as soon as they put the T on the end of it, it's like, are you the aunt? Are you the biological aunt? Well, not really, but kind of. She's living with me because, you know, things weren't good at her home. That's going to cause some problems, especially at the initial part of the investigation, to find out who's who and who's really who and where's the child supposed to be. Things that are left behind that shouldn't be left behind.
Phone.
Phone.
Pets.
Or a phone, a pet, medications.
Oh, yeah,
if something changes quickly, if the person is involved in some social grouping, whether it's a religious grouping or a social club, and they're heavily, heavily involved in, all of a sudden they stop instantly.
Oh.
And that stoppage is 1 month before the person is reported missing. There's a problem. And we need to resolve that problem before somebody in that team needs to resolve that problem. Now, I will tell you this, that one of the first things that's done, and there's a lot of technical terms to it, and mostly what the investigators call is just called pattern of life. Is a pattern of life is established about that person, and it comes under the thought process that no person simply exists. We all need other people in our lives. We all need other things in our life to live, love, and prosper. Well, that sounds almost like a Star Wars thing, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, that's Spock.
Doing the hand.
Oh, Spock. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm doing the hand
signal
there.
Live long and prosper.
Yeah.
And so as simple as it sounds, usually what you'll see in a detective bureau when they have one of these kind of cases, you'll see a graph that's usually made on a whiteboard because it's got 1,000 things written on it. In the middle will be the victim. And on the outshoots of that will be, what are those things that supports this lifestyle for this person or this life? And so I'll give you an example of one case. We had a missing person. It was a male from the law enforcement organization where I retired from. And he was an alcoholic. And we knew that he only drank a particular type of vodka that was this dirt cheap, I mean gut-wrenching vodka. Mm. And that was his preferred brand. He wouldn't drink anything but that. And he was missing. Yet when we started looking at his pattern of life, we realized that he had one credit card that was used at Quick Stops for the purchase of this type of vodka. And by getting that information through subpoena, we were able to track him as to which direction he was going and actually find him.
Oh, wow.
In a jurisdiction that was close to the last place where he had purchased a bottle of vodka. And so it was through that process of developing the pattern of life, we were able to move in a particular direction. On other cases, you take a look at the person and you start asking yourself questions. Where do they eat? How do they eat? What type of food do they eat? What does their credit card look like? What's their social media look like? Have they been on social media since they've been reported missing? If they have, whoa, we got to talk. Are they missing because they're running away from something? Or are they missing because they're running towards something? And those are all questions that the family has to answer as you're developing this. And we were joking during the break, you know, this pattern of life, but in most detective bureaus they call it the circle of life, and someone idiot starts singing the song and everybody else throws pencils at them to get them to shut up. But it's a low-grade investigative technique that pays off almost every time because we're not an island. We don't exist on our own. Mm-hmm. There's a support mechanism around us, and you start checking with enough people in that support mechanism or getting subpoenas served or writing search warrants on different records, recordations, that you can get enough information to get that investigation really amped up and really going quickly.
Going in the right direction.
Going in the right direction. Now, having said that, once it starts going in the right direction, one of the things that law enforcement is doing now is they are assigning investigators to make sure there's no confirmation bias. So as for me, here's my example. I want DeWalt 20-volt power tools. I want to replace all my power tools with DeWalt because I think they look cool. Now, someone can come to me and tell me that some other brand is better, but I have a confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. I've already decided DeWalt looks cool, and they gave me this really cool T-shirt, as a matter of fact.
That you actually are wearing.
DeWalt, yes. So I have a confirmation bias on that. And in order to make sure that that investigation is pristine from point A to point B, they'll actually bring in people that are not associated with that investigation and say, we need you to vet everything in this investigation to make sure we're not going down that happy trail of confirmation bias. And what that's doing is it's making the district attorney's job even easier because the district attorney doesn't sure. get caught up with the last minute Perry Mason point, you know, where they bring in somebody that we don't know about and says, oh, you know, he couldn't have done it because he was in Venice that day.
Right.
So this whole issue of relationships, remembering that we talked about this earlier, relationships change as time goes by. Some get stronger, some get weaker, some fall by the wayside. But every one of those people has a story to tell about your missing person. And so by the time you put all those pieces together, you've got a good profile of that missing person. And usually you have a direction to go. Our challenge with little kids, they don't have this.
They don't have the contacts.
No, they're not using credit cards yet.
Right. You know?
I was going to say they're not using telephones yet, cell phones yet, but most of them are, yeah.
But they're not. They don't have the history, and they also don't have the autonomy.
Exactly.
It isn't like little kids just went and opened a bank account and moved to a different place. That's not even possible.
Exactly.
So you know that there's always somebody involved with kids.
So that is a challenge. So here's what we do. We take that pattern of life technique and change it from the victim to the suspect. Makes a suspect tick? Suspect says, I wasn't there. John says, he was at my house. Cool. Can we confirm that? No, he can't. Why not? Because he got gas in Palo Cedro at 8 o'clock last night.
So he couldn't have been.
He couldn't have been at John's house.
This thing where they say that like their phones all match up and all that, that doesn't happen quickly, does it? I mean, it does on TV, but.
Nothing happens quickly with phone records.
Yeah, okay. So that's not like something you could figure out, like, oh, let's look at his phone records and see if he was there. That's not an early.
We will do that.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen at the beginning, does it?
No.
Yeah, that's like later.
No, it takes a while. You're dealing with a third party. And these third parties all require some type of legal document that absolves them of any legal issues for revealing that information. Mm-hmm. So they're either going to retire.
It's great to have a lot of rights, but when we have a lot of rights, it turns into, for you guys, a lot of roadblocks.
It does, but you know, it's here's a good example. On the average homicide case, patrol goes into a homicide case, somebody's dead, somebody's over the dead person, the suspect gets arrested. Everything comes to a halt. A search warrant is written to search that house for evidence of this case. And that doesn't take long. It takes longer to find somebody to sign the search warrant than it does to write the search warrant.
Right.
But and it is an involved process. I will give the investigators credit for that. It is an involved process, but a lot of them do pre-work.
Sure.
Because one of the pages is to talk about your expertise in that particular area. So that's done ahead of time and in their computers. Then they've got to find somebody to sign a search warrant. And, of course, nighttime, it's tough trying to find people to answer their phone.
Yeah, nobody commits crimes and does all that stuff in the day between 8 and 5.
It doesn't happen. So as we kind of wrap this thing up, I want to talk about where we're going with missing persons cases, about the how things are evolving. Technology is unbelievable. We have parents that have iWatches on their children and GPS sensors in their backpacks. Fabulous, absolutely fabulous, and that's helping a lot. A lot of the schools now have cameras, and so they're recording who goes and who comes during school hours. That's phenomenal, and that's helping a lot. So this whole technology thing has helped us as far as the missing persons investigations go. Use of canines is absolutely blowing up right now. And we have gone from two types of dogs in law enforcement. We had scent dogs, and then we had dogs that would do the work of another police officer. So they would actually apprehend the suspect, pull the suspect down on the ground.
Our favorite ones from like the cops shows.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Releasing the dog. No, yeah. He's biting me.
Yeah, but Aaron, I know that you were yelling, release the dog as soon as the show came on, right?
Yeah, where's exactly. The dog?
Yeah.
Please do the dogs.
So here we are in 2023, and we're using dogs that are trained to look for teeth, to sniff out teeth for missing persons and or homicide victims, which is amazing. Our resource deployment issue has exponentially grown. It's not uncommon to see multiple agencies at a child abduction or a child missing case. And now it's really cool because now we're involving families in the investigation, where families are setting up Facebook accounts. And guess who monitors those Facebook accounts? Law enforcement.
Yeah.
Guess who they're looking for? Bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The family gets to do something, finally. Lastly, we now have family advocates. So the poor detective that has the case, that has six other detectives asking him questions, where should we go, what should we do, now has somebody that the family can talk to that's not associated with the actual investigation but knows what's going on.
Hmm. We had a couple of, I know I only got a couple of minutes left, but recently we had a couple of cases locally that were cracked. I think one in Anderson, one in Red Bluff. What was the kicker on those? I mean, what solved them?
Technology or what was the push?
The
push was the individual investigators that had those cases sitting on their desk looking at them going, are we ready yet? Are we ready yet? Are we ready yet?
Oh, okay.
Technology's ready. I think we're ready. Can we do this? And then once they got the okay to do it, then they realized they were queued up and they were in line.
Okay.
And then once it was examined, they got the results.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because a lot of times, I mean, you wonder, you know, these crimes are committed and it's like years later
yes.
they pull the trigger on it and it was the guy you thought it was all the time.
You know, Occam's razor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, the most obvious one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that on the missing part, we didn't talk about the public. So, you know, we've got like 30 seconds, but the public is really important. The case in Anderson was somebody who thought something looked weird.
Yes.
I mean, that's not a camera. That's not technology. That's not DA. That's a human who looks at it and goes, hey, wait a minute. That person seems like a weirdo. What are they doing with eight kids? Like that, you can't underscore that and you can't turn that into technology. People are a good source.
Exactly.
For things.
And that person who called wasn't saying, I'm calling to report
They said something weird.
I'm calling to report something weird. And boy, did it turn out to be weird.
Yeah. All right. Got to jump off here. Thank you so much, Paul Skinner.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Was nice, the party was bumping.
Hey, yeah, V-I-O.
And everybody having a ball.
Hey, hey, V-I-O.
Until the fellas got the name calling.
V-I-O.
And the girls respond to the call. Hey, I have a poor white shout out.
Hey,